Are we ready to begin? Okay, I'm not sure how many of you here were here last time. We spoke about the challenge of astrophysics to the Jewish conception of the creation of the world. And I don't want to really repeat all of the information that we had discussed last three, four times, but I do want to review a little bit of some of the major points that we were talking about. In the last meeting that we had, there were three essential points that were made. First, the study of science is a religious necessity related to the notion of what I call Da'at Elohim, knowledge of God. It is not true that in all yeshiva curriculums, Da'at Elohim is in fact emphasized, knowledge of God. Certainly, when I spoke to a person who called me up and said that I want to change my child from the Da'at Yeshiva and place him at the Hillel, he says, what do I gain or what do I lose? So I said to him that certainly his environment at Da'at Yeshiva will encourage Yirat Shamayim and fear of heaven. There's no doubt that in the right-wing yeshivot, they do that extraordinarily well. Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, without question. As well as his friends will encourage, the peer group will encourage his religiosity. However, what he won't ever get from the right-wing yeshivot is what we're calling Da'at Elohim, which means knowledge of God. To do so, one has to have a good, strong basis, let's say, in the sciences and in the humanities as well, to achieve that. In the right-wing yeshivot, secular knowledge, understanding is, of course, limited at best. So he will not ever achieve, in the Maimonidean sense, Da'at Elohim. And what we are saying over here, that to achieve Da'at Elohim nowadays, and it's true for the last 1,000 years, one needed to have a very strong background in the sciences. We are in fact commanded to love God and to stand in awe of God. V'ahav Hashem Elokecha, love God. L'man tirah, stand in awe of God. In order to love God and stand in awe of God, one must know the object before whom one stands in awe of, and one must have some sense of the object that, thank you, that one has to love, and that is called Elohim, and therefore one needs Da'at Elohim. The only way that one is able to know God and thereby to love God and stand in awe of God is to know God's works, namely God's creed and God's deed. The creed, as we mentioned, is the Torah itself. One studies Torah, one gets a sense of who God is, and one studies the deed of God, which is the creation or studying physics, known Talmudically as Ma'aseh Bereshit. To understand Ma'aseh Bereshit gives you a sense of who the Creator is. So therefore, we had made the point, the study of Ma'aseh Bereshit brings you closer to Da'at Elohim, which brings you closer to love God and stand in awe of God. Last time, we had proven this point from readings from the Rambam, Yisodei HaTorah, the Rambam Hilchot Teshuvah, and Sefer HaMitzvot. You will note that these three sources are normative Jewish sources. Sefer Torah is from Mishneh Torah. It's from Halakha. Hilchot Teshuvah is from Mishneh Torah. And Sefer HaMitzvot is an independent work. All normative sources that nobody denies. I intentionally did not bring you proof of this point from Moreh Nevuchim, the God perplexed. That's not what we will call a normative Jewish source. Why is it not normative? Because many in the yeshiva world will deny. Some will deny the Rambam even wrote the work, which is absolutely silly. I don't know what word one can use to deny that. We all know that Rambam wrote this work from the very earliest sources. Rabbi Abraham, the Rambam's son himself, of course, attests to that fact. The Rambam wrote Moreh Nevuchim. But in the yeshiva world, they cannot live with that sort of intellectual dissonance. What do we mean by intellectual dissonance? No, you can't come in. That's what the word means, can't come in. What's intellectual dissonance? Dissonance is the phenomenon wherein you're obligated to acknowledge a source because it's absolute. In your world view, the Rambam is absolute in the yeshiva world view. Why is he absolute? Because one cannot operate halakhically without having an awareness, a sense of, an appreciation for, and a mastery even, of the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. We will make the point again, and we'll make this point in about 2 or 3 weeks, when we talk about the Rambam, that no great work in halakha, in hashkafa, in pashanut, in any of these fields, has been written in the last 1,000 years without relying on, to one degree or another, the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. So one has to acknowledge the Mishneh Torah or the Rambam's Yad HaChazakah. On the other hand, what does one do when that very same person, for some strange reason, wrote a work as controversial and as difficult as Moreh Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed? That guide is so far removed from your worldview, you can't deal with it. You can't appreciate it. You can't accept it as the same author as the Mishneh Torah, which you must accept. That's called intellectual dissonance. Give me a contemporary example where that's happening right this second. Exactly. Very good. Rabbi Soloveitchik. Whereas Rabbi Soloveitchik is the preeminent authority in the last 100, 150 years in Talmudic analysis. Nobody can call themselves knowledgeable in Talmudic analysis, which is a very sophisticated discipline, without having an awareness of what Rabbi Soloveitchik did to the Talmud. His unique form of analysis. And therefore the yeshiva world has to acknowledge. On the other hand, Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, wrote revolutionary and radical works. Ish HaLacha, Lonely Man of Faith, in many of his oral discourses. All of that shows the Rav to be way, way beyond your normative Talmudic model. So what does one do? One must acknowledge the Talmudic works of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and yet, jarring that image of the Rabbi Soloveitchik, of the Rav, known as the Rav, as a Talmudist, is this philosophical orientation, exactly the same as the Rambam. And therefore you have to either deny Rabbi Soloveitchik did that, or what was true 25 years ago is that you didn't refer to the Rabbi Soloveitchik as the Rav, as the rabbi par excellence, as we Yeshiva University did, but rather you refer to him as, nobody here knows that, because you're all too young.
JB.
You're not too young.
Really?
Very good. Good move. They referred to him as J.B. He was known as J.B. Soloveitchik, Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. So that was a way of acknowledging who he was, but saying it derisively, mockingly. But they had to acknowledge him. The intellectual power of Rabbi Soloveitchik's works and the intellectual power of the Rambam's works was so overwhelming that one has to accept and acknowledge, yet, on the other hand, they both had written works that were far from the norm of the Talmudic student. So they both produced intellectual dissonance, and every Talmudist, both 1,000 years ago and contemporarily, has to deal with this phenomenon whichever best way they can. Ignoring that they wrote something, 500 years from now, there's no doubt that the yeshiva world will say, well, so didn't write Only Man of Faith or Ish HaLacha. They will say that, didn't write it. And there'll be some guy named Labaton, four generations, they'll say, no, I swear that he did. No, what do you know? Etc. And somebody wrote a PhD thesis on this very topic of cultural intellectual dissonance. Okay, good. So I quote for you from the Rambam's halachic works that one has the obligation of studying science in order to achieve Da'at Elohim, which means to achieve love of God as well as standing in awe of God. So one must study Ma'aseh Bereshit or creation. Good. We then, point B, reviewed some of the elementary statistics of the universe, which you have to know in order to understand God. So very briefly, we said that the universe is alleged to be 12.2 billion years old, give or take a year or two. There are 100 million galaxies in the universe. There are 100 billion trillion stars in the universe. And parenthetically, since the last time we spoke till now, I am very sure that one or two new galaxies were created. God has not been resting, not been on vacation, didn't go to, where did I not go? To Dominican Republic? I didn't go to that for one reason or another. But rather, God on a daily basis is creating galaxies. We spoke about a quasar which travels 29,695 miles per second. Say that again, I will. 29,695 miles per second, second to the speed of light. And that a neutron star, which is a star, average star that has died, has the density, right before it becomes a black hole in space, of one teaspoon weighs 600 million tons. Right? All along with the Milky Way galaxy, which is our galaxy, 100,000 light years long. We know what a light year is. And that our solar system, which is a small, tiny speck, nothing more than that, and considerably less than that, in our Milky Way galaxy, is traveling right this moment at 11 million miles per day, and in 200 million years, it shall traverse our small, tiny Milky Way galaxy. Again, the solar system, which is this little point over here, it's a speck, right over there, right? Is traveling 11 million miles per day around the periphery of our Milky Way galaxy, which is the size of this table. If you could imagine that, this table is 100,000 light years long. And in 200 million years, our solar system will traverse... How come nobody said wow yet? Okay, then that's high. Okay, that's fine then. But that's a wow statement. You have to walk at it and say, you had to be in the stars. That's an absurd statement. It makes no sense on rational grounds. That's why everybody should walk out of here as an existentialist, not as a rationalist. You cannot be a rationalist and live in this universe because of all that I just said, which is obvious. In our small, tiny Milky Way galaxy, which is 100,000 light years, which means it's 100,000 times 5.9 trillion miles long. Take 5.9 trillion... trillion miles, and what about 100,000? That's the extent of our galaxy, which is only a small speck among the 100 million galaxies, and our solar system is even smaller, and that's traveling 11 million miles per day, and in 200 million years, it'll traverse our galaxy. That's astounding. Now, interesting, I just came across from last time something that is called a gamma ray. Have you heard of a gamma ray? You should have heard of what gamma ray is. Okay, good. Sorry? Yes, exactly. Now you know why it made the Hulk green, when you hear the following. Gamma ray bursts are the most violent events since the Big Bang itself. They're about 10 times more energetic, have more energy, than the most powerful supernova, which is an exploding star, and at their peak are about 100,000 times brighter than an entire galaxy. And a galaxy has about, give or take, 100 billion stars in it. A galaxy has about 100 billion stars. So imagine what the energy the star expresses, right? In 1 second, our sun, we mentioned this last time, our sun in 1 second expresses more energy than has been used in the history of the United States. In 1 second, with all the lights that my wife and kids leave open, the sun expresses, it's amazing. The sun expresses more, radiates more energy than in 1 second than in history of the United States, which is also absurd. So now that sun, which is extraordinarily powerful, take 100, we said 100 billion of those in a galaxy, which is very large, and is 100,000 times brighter than an entire galaxy. This gamma ray, right? And until recently, these titanic eruptions were the most mysterious events in astronomy. Right? So this particular professor, Jonathan Katz, has been able to translate what that means scientifically into plain English, which is interesting. Good. That's another fact of the universe. So now, all of these facts of the universe, you must begin with facts, raises what I said last time was three essential questions that challenge religion. One, creation versus the eternal state of the universe. Two, the age of the universe, which is 12.2 billion versus 5,764. And three, the evolution of man from ape. Right? Good. We easily solved the creation versus eternity question. We had read from contemporary books of physics that speak about black holes, and we came to the conclusion regarding creation. Virtually all astrophysicists today do in fact accepts the notion of creation. As late as 1947, when George Gamow spoke about creation versus the eternity of the universe, which was then the prevailing scientific opinion, he was laughed at by Frederick Hoyle and others, right? Frederick Hoyle was the one who coined the term Big Bang derisively, but it stuck. And only in 1967, when Wilson and Arjo Penzias heard the background radiation, which had to be the Big Bang, was the Big Bang as a theory proposed and virtually accepted by every scientist at this point in time. So that's not a difficult issue. But issue number two, trying to solve the age of the universe, was a bit more difficult. We discussed that in terms of the Gemara Pesachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu emet, God seal is truth, and therefore we have to pursue truth. And we had to discuss, is the number 5764 a holy number? Where did it come from? It's Amoraitic at best. The Rambam in 288 of Elohim told us we don't have to follow any Talmudic or medicinal opinions that contradict scientific facts. We do not have to follow any medicinal or scientific Talmudic opinions that contradict scientific facts. Moreno Bochim 2:8, the men of Abraham in Mechamot Hashem, as well as Rav Chai Gaon, all make this point. You are not obligated to follow any Talmudic, medicinal, or scientific opinions that contradict scientific fact. I say that thrice because it's viewed as somewhat radical in the contemporary Syrian world, I would say. In the more learned Ashkenazic world, that is not, of course, the prevailing opinion, what the Syrian world holds. So therefore, though it's held strongly in the Syrian world that the Talmud's medicinal and scientific opinions have to hold sway, it's against the Rambam, Ibn Abraham, Rabbi Chai Gaon, Sa'adja Gaon, and others that we could point to. One is not obligated to accept the Talmudic view of science or the Talmudic view of medicine. To the extent where in other sources, one can find where the Talmudic rabbis themselves had said, Nir'u divrehem medivarenu. The Greek philosophers were right, and we were wrong. Nir'u divrehem medivarenu. It's Masechet Yomah. I believe it's Masechet Yomah, where that statement is made. So the Talmud itself says we're wrong about science. So, therefore, the number 5764 is not necessarily a holy number, and therefore, even if it were, the Talmud says it, we have to accept it. And therefore as well, if we choose to, we must in fact interpret the word day in Bereshit as a longer period of time, 24 hours. Rather, we can interpret it as stages of the evolution of the universe, and there's nothing religiously wrong with that. As well, we ended last time with a traditional source, Arya Kaplan, who was very well respected in the right-wing world because of his credentials as a right-wing personality. And he himself, in a work that was published posthumously, we discussed, he came up with a Kabbalistic source, as interpreted by a work called Sefer HaTimunah, where at the end of his calculations, the universe is close to 15 billion years old, which fits well with our scientific opinions. So here you have an early traditional source that is saying the same thing as science. Some of you pointed out to me last time after the class that you shouldn't need that traditional source, which is true. You don't need to have that traditional source. Once we have proven to the best of our ability the scientific statement that the universe is 12.2 or 13 or 14 billion years old, then if that's proven scientifically, then I should not be bound by any old Talmudic sources. Yes?
I think the problem with that traditional source is that it's so close to the scientific view that you blurred really the message.
Right.
The message is that the traditional source is telling us we can think of universe as other than 5764. It doesn't really matter that he said 15 million.
Right. Correct. Good.
3 million, it would have been just as good.
Right, but this happens to correspond.
But that may actually miss the point. Because his reasoning may not really fit scientific fact.
It doesn't have to fit, it's just a traditional source that fits. And would it take it for what it's worth?
Well, it's worth that he's giving you an option.
Yes, that's correct, exactly. Yeah, but correct, I agree. But even so, it's this source is going to produce a intellectual is going to produce intellectual dissonance again in the right wing world. Because Ari Kaplan said it, we have to accept it, and yet it's contrary to 5764. What do I do now? They start sweating. Because it doesn't work from their point of view. But that's okay, we don't care about that. So now, those are some of the options. Certainly one can read Schroeder's book, and he tries to explain that really 5764 literally equals 12.2 billion years. Which you don't have to worry about, you can read the first chapter of the book, and he makes a good case for that. You may or may not want to accept it, not important. Or we could say that Torah is here to teach us not science per se, but rather Torah is here to teach us ethics, morality, and spirituality, holiness. How to live life with holiness, how to live life as a Jew is what Torah is all about. And therefore, Torah is absolutely true, and science may be absolutely true, and as long as each discipline stays within its appropriate boundaries, then we can live comfortably with both. Science is true, and religion is true, Torah is true, and where Torah does give us a quote-unquote scientific backdrop, then that has to be, in some degree or other, reinterpreted. As Harambam tells us in Moreh Nevuchim 2:25 to do, to reinterpret that which does not fit. And simply over here, science serves, in a felicitous phrase, as a handmaiden to Torah. Science is simply a commentary, as archaeology would be a commentary, as Akkadian dictionaries would be a commentary. All of those are simple commentaries on what the Torah is really all about. So good. With all of that, we had actually were able to solve the first two questions that we had raised. A, in terms of creation versus eternity, and B, the age of the universe. Any questions about all that we've done? You all happy with that? You should be. There's a lot more to say about those issues, and a lot of questions that can be asked about those issues. But we won't go into that right now. Right now, this evening, above and beyond the astrophysical, above and beyond the notion of creation versus eternity, we want to talk about evolution, or how the animal kingdom developed as a subcategory of evolution. And we're going to treat this issue separately, is whether or not the human being did in fact develop, evolve from the animal kingdom. That is, one may theoretically argue that though I accept the animal kingdom as having evolved or developed from an earlier stage, and there's a great deal of evidence that points to that, thousands upon thousands of experiments have been done that support evolution, one may choose to take the position that the human being was directly created by God with no evolution whatsoever, and thereby I'm going to read Bereshit with my bifocals. That is, I'm going to accept evolution in one area, but I'm going to insist that Bereshit, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kav Hen Kav Vav, which talks about the human being per se, or Bereshit Perek Bet, which speaks about the human being per se, that your God directly created the human being with the same genetic matter, because we do share 99.1 or 2% of the same genetic matter as the most developed mammal, right? So if we do in fact share that, God created us in that way. Now, as we get to that, you may want to challenge that position. I may want to challenge that position. But that is at least a theoretical option that we're going to keep open at this point, right? We may not agree with it, but we want to be aware of this possibility, right? So these are the three areas that we speak about: science and religion, astrophysical, creation, and evolution. And tonight we want to speak about evolution. Take note that, of course, this debate about what evolution means and how does one respond to it religiously began One would say in 1859. Why 1859? What happened in 1859?
Darwin's book.
Yes. After 5 years of taking the trip, The Origin of the Species. 5 years. We'll get to that in a minute. But the broader debate that we're speaking about really lasted 400 to 500 years ago, beginning with Galileo, when he made his pronouncements and was lambasted by the church. And this debate has gone on since then. Since Galileo's opening statement, and the church is very upset about it, this debate has gone on less intensely in the Jewish world. Less intensely. To the extent where Rav Kook, which we'll come to next time, the great chief rabbi of Israel, first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, died in 1935, was very comfortable accepting evolution. Not only that, this again is going to cause some intellectual dissonance. The very famous Mishneh commentary, Tiferet Israel, who wrote a magnificent commentary on the Mishnah himself, in the late 19th century, he as well was very comfortable accepting evolution. In his Derasha for Rosh Hashanah, he speaks about evolution. It was intellectually appropriate in the 1870s and 80s to speak about evolution, and he said, it's no problem for us. The church had a problem with it. We as Jews have a problem. Now we've kind of retrogressed, and now many right-wing circles have a problem with evolution. Now the Pope does not. The Pope has made numerous statements not having a problem with it, but many in the right-wing world have intense problem. There's a particular Rabbi Ideal who this very day always rants and raves about evolution. He started when I first came 22 years ago, and this very day still says things that deny it, which is absurd almost. It's saying the equivalent of the earth is flat. And maybe he holds that also, I don't know. So, it's the same intellectual level of sophistication to deny both. If you know evolution, and you want to deny it based on your knowledge of what it really is, in its most sophisticated formulation, not in its Darwinian formulation, I have no problem with that. There are all kinds of problems with evolution, which we'll talk about maybe as we go along. But when you don't know anything about it and you deny it, it's irresponsible. Sorry?
Are you going to outline exactly the evolution you're referring to?
I'm sorry, Ken.
Now outline exactly...
Well, I will?
Yes.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, absolutely. We'll evolve to that point, if you don't read. Before we turn old and gray.
Should be the first understanding of what...
We are going to, yes. This is only backdrop.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Correct. Okay, good. So this raging debate, we have to realize, understand how intense it is, how angry it is. Both sides are raging at each other. We understand why. We understand why. A tremendous amount of your own self-perception, who you think you are, rides on this debate, on the outcome of this debate. These are two world views, and they mean very different things. Ultimate meaning of your life, of my life, or the lack of meaning in my life and your life, depends upon this debate. Now the question is, before we begin, is there any possibility of reconciliation? Say?
Yeah, there is.
Yes, there is. Good. If Philip said it, I buy it. Case closed. We have to now just prove it. But I do, in fact, believe there is the possibility of reconciliation. How could we affect this reconciliation? Do we choose to? Yes, we choose to. Because we want to be intellectually honest, responsible, and because we want to search for truth. Our goal in life should be searching for truth. Who ever heard of searching for lie? We're not going to search for lie, we search for truth. So we therefore have to try to reconcile both these positions. Right? Now, part of this has to be with regard to each system, each way of viewing the world, has to understand its own discipline, and has to understand and know the limits of its discipline, the parameters of its discipline. Science has to do science well, and religion has to do religion well, and as long as neither one goes beyond its boundaries, there's a hope of reconciliation. Good. Does this solve our problem? Not completely. We are going to see that evolution is going to challenge our religious worldview with no hope of reconciliation if, in fact, we are, fill in the blanks, if we are tied to a literal understanding of the biblical text. There is not going to be any way of reconciling this issue or the other issues as well for that matter, if we're tied to a literal understanding of the Bible. Now, I could raise the question, are we tied to that? Can you point to me any biblical source which demands interpretation from you? Yeah, you can. Give me any biblical source. Give me one. All over. Give me one. No. Any biblical, text. Okay, good. Good. Yad HaChazaka. We have to reinterpret. We cannot live with a little understanding of God's physical corporeality. Right? We all agree with that? Good. Another one? That's not as clear. I wouldn't be happy if you did interpret that literally. I'd walk around protecting my eyes. And you're right. We have to reinterpret that. How about the following? Do not see the goat in its mother's milk. Do I take that literally? No. Both in the halakhic realm, I reinterpret, as well as in God's realm, I reinterpret. And even in this following statement, Arim gedulot upsurot ad hashamayim. Were there cities, fortresses, that were built ad hashamayim? Of course not. The Jews did not confront any city that was built ad hashamayim. Right? We all agree with that? So therefore, that has to be reinterpreted. That's a metaphor. So the Bible itself does, in fact, itself tells us that there are metaphorical statements with regard to God, even halakhically. Does not mean do not see the goat in its mother's milk. It means that literally. It does not mean that halakhically. So I am obligated, both halakhically and in various narrative portions of the biblical text, to reinterpret. How about when God tells us to circumcise your heart, or let live out him? Is that meant to be taken literally?
No.
You sure? Otherwise, call the Mohel. We all need him right now. How do you circumcise? You don't circumcise your heart, right? So we all agree that the Bible itself is telling us, Tanakh itself is telling us, not to take me literally in everything that I say. Now, admittedly, there are certain narratives where it's not that clear. What perhaps would you say is the most questionable, gray, not clear biblical narrative that I don't feel comfortable taking literally, but I really may have to? Good. Gan Eden. Gan Eden is a biblical text. I have a precedent of not necessarily taking it literally. A speaking snake is not my idea of a literal text. The text does not tell me that the snake stops speaking. So maybe Gan Eden, maybe, perhaps, shouldn't upset you, maybe Gan Eden is also, perhaps, a metaphor. Sa'aja Gaon seems to indicate that in his understanding of it, so does the Rambam. But I'm not convinced that so that's true. We have to analyze that and see if we have any precedent, if we're not comfortable with it. Or, in fact, of course, Ma'aser Bereshit. Are we obligated to take Ma'aser Bereshit literally? The Ramban would say no. The Ramban himself, in his commentary to Bereshit, would say, don't take the first 7 days of creation literally.
Doesn't everybody say that?
No, I know a lot of rabbis deal to take it literally. Absolutely. Yeah, and in Brooklyn as well, but I don't want to say anything about Beit Brooklyn. I'm here now.
They do that so that they don't have to explain Bereshit.
No, they believe it. No, they're not sophisticated enough to know these other commentaries.
I thought every commentary was basically very in depth, and people don't want to teach Bereshit because it has so many, you know, metaphors. And
okay, that's all true, but there are those who take it literally. I mean, that's obvious. It's obvious, and those who take it literally in many schools and many shuls and many places. Take it literally. No, they believe it literally. Now, I think to say that we're not taking Bereshit literally is a radical statement. I would say this publicly on tape. Who wasn't me who said it? Phil said it, right. He's braver than I.
I once told a right-winger that there are a few Orthodox rabbis who don't take the 6 days of creation literally.
Listen to this, Alan. You just told some
the overreacted ego.
Who overreacted?
Give me the names of all
the
rabbis
who
say that you don't take it literally, and I'm going to report them to the RCA, the Rabbinical Council.
Wait. You didn't mention me. I hope you didn't mention my name. I'm a member of Good Standing the RCA so far. Can I ask you who the rabbi was?
I prefer no names.
Maybe privately. That's interesting to know. I mean, I have a guess who would do something like that. Okay, and it's an interesting question. What percentage of the RCA, which is the Rabbinical Council of America, which represents 1,400 rabbis, it's the largest rabbinical organization in the world. It's the largest rabbinical organization of Orthodox rabbis in the world. So it's a good question as to how many of those rabbis take it literally. I would guess more than 50, 60, 70%.
Take it literally?
I think 50%. I mean, they would not do a study. Right.
They would not want to make it public what they really
for sure. Think. For sure. Absolutely true. Okay, but that's all interesting. So I think 50% maybe them. So that's interesting. So Alan, you stand corrected, right?
No, I don't know.
Well, Phil just told you.
Yes, I understand what you told me. Maybe a few, but I don't know if it's a few.
50%.
Maybe they just use it as, to, you know, like I said, to make things easier.
Do the work. Call up, ask. Okay. 50%.
No,
I'm standing
exactly
at 50%.
That, just to support their philosophy, but I don't know if it's truly their philosophy.
I would think yes. But okay, that's my experience. That, let alone the right one, certainly even the RCA would, I think, say that. Okay, good. So if one is a literalist, one's going to have a hard time with Bereshit and evolution. Right? Even though the gates of interpretation are not closed to me in the Rambam's famous formulation. It shouldn't be so surprising or radical to say what we're saying right now. What, are we wedded to a literal interpretation of the Bible? No, we've proven both narratively and halakhically that we're not to be wedded to a literal interpretation of the Bible. Although, despite saying that, we also are not going to come to a conclusion that we will interpret everything non-literally. We have to be concerned about the slippery slope argument. We're not going to, so we have to then come to some kind of understanding. What do we interpret literally? What don't we interpret literally? That's part of what we have to discuss. Harvey, sorry to keep you waiting.
No, that's what I was going to say with Bob.
It's one of the rabbis, Max. You're in trouble. I knew it. Yeah.
Sorry.
Which side? Was he pro or against? Literal. Pro. Again.
We have the Tanakh. We have the Peshat. When do we take literal? When do we start going the other way? When do we stop?
I'm not discussing that now. That's next year's series. Maybe. That's an important question. It's a critical. Sajiga on chapter 7, Imnot Vedeot. Yes? Discusses that exact question. As is Haramban, when in the Bukhim 225, discusses that exact question. So we're not going to talk about it right now, but next year maybe. Okay, I'm sorry? Yeah.
Your belief that the Bible shouldn't be taken literally, or that... The interpretation, that's a modern interpretation.
What is?
That if you're looking at Bereshit and saying that it's not a literal interpretation, the Garden of Eden is not a literal interpretation.
I just quoted a 1,000-year-old source, two of them, three of them, that does not take those narratives as literal. Ramban, Sa'adja, virtually every rationalist of the medieval period. Talmudically, I'm not sure. That's what we have to think about. What did Philo say? Philo also allegorized hugely. He's Talmudic. But Talmudically, I'm not sure. But certainly, the 1,000-year rational tradition of Sa'adja, Halevi, Kuzari, all that, they're not taking these things literally. Rambam, certainly not.
So you're saying that medieval Jewry didn't accept Bereshit as a literal interpretation?
No. When you use that term, medieval Jewry, talking about a huge expanse of Jews. No. Broadly speaking, Spanish Jewry, represented by Harambam, Ramban, Halevi, Radak, Ralbaz in France, Mersanides, at least those, and Provence with some, Provence which is southern France, Provence, which is very... Sorry?
How about
Kreskas? Kreskas as well, Spanish. Yes, he was a good friend of mine. So northern Spain and southern France, which touched each other, they basically had a philosophical tradition. certainly go to northern France with the tradition of Rashi, Baraita HaSafot, and Rashbam, Ben Otam, all of those were much more likely to take all that we just discussed as literal. So one can use the phrase medieval Jewry. It breaks up as well in the eastern, that's the western, in the eastern part of the world. The tradition of Hofni and Sa'adja Gaon in Iraq, Babylonia, Babel, and Egypt later with the Rambam, all those would be more in the Banner school of Harambam, who would not take these things literally. All of Moreh Nevuchim, first section, part one, talks about how to not take the Torah literally. All of the first section of Harambam, Moreh Nevuchim. But it wasn't only Rambam, it was that whole Spanish school, broadly conceived, who were rationalists, could not understand these terms. That comes such on Harvey's point, which is, how do we really distinguish between what should or should not? I say God's corporeality, that was easy. Garden of Eden, I think, is much more difficult to or to not take it literally. But one should feel comfortable, Jewishly, if one chooses not to take it literally, because there were great rabbis prior to this period of time who did not take it literally.
No, I understand what you're saying. I don't...
You don't disagree with what I'm saying.
I made this with you.
Happy Twitter, if I gave you all facts. These are facts on the table. What could I do? Wait, these are facts.
But you say, I mean, Maimonides is may stand aside. It may not be in the traditional vein of Jewish thought.
Wait, even if he's not, he's the Rambam. Even if he were not traditional, I don't know what you mean by traditional. You may mean Sama Hasidim are only traditional, and everybody else to the left of them are heretics. So then you're using very fuzzy terms. You know, I don't, who's traditional? The Rambam is really normative. Again, as mentioned before, nobody moves in any world without the Rambam. So the Rambam is the Rambam. One day the Rambam said it, it has to be viewed as seriously Jewish and Orthodox, in some sense. Because the Rambam is the Rambam. But I'm quoting you, the Rambam, I'm banned to Aja, how later...
You're saying now, even in today's day, there are Orthodox Jewish rabbis who take...
Some non-Jewish rabbis, yeah.
Who take...
the pagans, some of them.
Who take the Bible as literal.
Absolutely, yeah, 50%, yeah. I think, I would say.
And that's a tradition that goes back a thousand years.
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't make any hasty generalizations. So, yes, that's absolutely true. Today you're going to find the same split, I would say, between the rationalists and the others, the irrationalists, which are those who cannot accept the Bible as literal. Certainly, what's interesting is that we've progressed in a thousand years that I don't know if anybody, even my pagan friends, that take the statements in the Bible which talk about God physically and corporeally, right? That God came down. In Sodom Amorah. Do they think that literally God came down? No. They cannot. Right? So they cannot. So even those Jews, rabbis, who don't want to take an Eden literally, or don't want to take it literally, and don't want to interpret it, they must see that most or much or some of the Bible is halakhically and narratively metaphorical. You have to interpret. You can't take those statements about God. There's tons of them, as we pointed out, right? And statements about halachot. For example, Torah tells you, two men are fighting, and along comes the wife of one of the men, and she sees the husband fighting with the other person, and she's really upset. So she hits one of the people fighting her husband below the belt. What does Torah say? Cut off her hand, don't have compassion. We did it literally? No. We interpret that monetary compensation. So everybody agrees with that. So halakhically, in that very serious vein, but even narratively in the theological context, and even orat levavchem, circumcise your hearts, everybody agrees those are non-literal. So Gan Eden is a little bit more problematic. So even our literalists are going to accept the principle of interpretation of the Bible. What the criteria is, and what should our criteria be, is Harvey's question, which we'll get to next year. Maybe. Probably. Are we on the same page? David, quickly.
I think a distinction has to be made between the popular religion and, as often called, the religion of the thinkers.
Yeah, okay, good.
But how much but that comes, where the question comes out of that. How much of the popular religion influences the answer to the other question that Harvey asked? When do we draw the line? Is it when people can accept it?
Okay, good. That's an interesting question related to the new discipline called sociology of knowledge. Knowledge is knowledge in a certain cultural context, certain sociological grouping. You could have subgroups, you could have all kinds of stuff, and that's true. What people can accept in one age is not what people can accept in another age. One of the famous aphorisms is one age's heresy is another age's orthodoxy, and vice versa. It would be applicable to the Rambam. The Rambam was viewed as a heretic in his own time, so one age's heresy is viewed today as orthodoxy. So that's sociology of knowledge. So the answer to your question is yes. That one has to see the social context, and what might make sense in the modern Orthodox Ashkenazic world would not necessarily make sense in the Syrian world, and even between Brooklyn and Deal, you find differences. Astoundingly so. In Brooklyn, you could perhaps, I think, speak comfortably, correct me if I'm wrong, about evolution as a viable religious option. In Brooklyn, you can, in Deal, you cannot. You cannot do what I'm doing here tonight in Deal without getting stoned.
There's a mob outside.
Oh, the stoners are here too? Do not do. So is that clear? David, so you're right. Yes, the answer is right. Yes, yeah, I'm sorry.
When you deal with this question, how much weight do you give to the... I would say it's a fact that the worst nightmares of the critics of rationalism came true.
That's true.
So when they warned us 300 years ago, if you go down this path, 80%, 90% of the people are going to chuck religion. They were right. So now when the right wing just said, we don't want any of this, they're talking from experience. They said, look what happened. So you could prove to me you have 5% of the people that juggle both? What about the 95%
that can't? You're asking a political question.
That's what I'm saying. Well, on top of the science, don't you have to factor that? I think it's a very, very valid point.
The Rambam, that's not a valid point, it's a terrible point. Would the Rambam want, if the Pasuk Kohelet, Ahad Eir Lo Matzati, would you want,
are you willing to do that?
Well, yes.
To write off 95% of the people and say, well, break out their philosophy books and go through all that stuff, or listen to, nice, pleasant lectures from different kind of viewpoint, and have more meaningful lives.
And be pagans.
Says you.
No, we know they're pagans. That's a serious point. What would the Rambam say about that? I'm saying that for the last 2,000 years plus, we've had both. We had both. We had the rationalists, and had those who pursue truth to its innermost core no matter what. The proof this works is Kadosh and Magna David and Deal. We do both very nicely. It all works out very well.
I'm saying, don't you think if the rationalists had a few more people in their camp, in other words, had religious people in their camp, and they didn't keep bleeding members every time they went to college and 2 years later just chucked everything they learned for 20 years, the other side would be much, much less defensive.
That's correct. No, you're right. You're right. That's true. But I'm not going to chuck the entire program because we've lost.
You have to always be cognizant of that.
Absolutely cognizant. But we have not trained the right leaders. And therefore, we haven't been able to go to those college kids and save them. We haven't done what's right. But Yeshiva University has done that, by and large. Yeshiva University is a great example of training people in both worlds where there's not a dropout rate to a great degree. Yes, it's not a perfect institution. No institution is perfect, and there are problems, but it's doing a great job at trying to maintain. Rabbi Soloveitchik has maintained this tense relationship between these two worlds. So I think we're making headway in the Ashkenazic world, not in the Syrian world. Look at the more global picture of the modern Ashkenazic world as opposed to the Syrian world.
Look at it.
No, I don't think that's true.
What are you turning black?
No, it's not turning black intellectually. Even those people that
50% of the RCE you just said, why you graduates
That's over the last 50 years. That's over the last 50 years.
Today?
Hold on. Even those people who you are calling, let's say, black hat, right, or right wing, also have a degree of sophistication in accepting and in dealing with all this, because they went through YU. Take a YU.
They have that on off switch.
Yeah, either one. Correct. Either one. Right. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. That's correct. That's one of the options. You're right. But that's only a partial experiment. And we, you know, we're still evolving. The experiment is still evolving. It's not there. Quickly, David, I got to go on.
One of the problems that I
you have to leave soon.
I don't have to leave. But one of the problems that I've seen
look what happens.
Discussions like this is that we fail to realize that we're in a very early stage
exactly.
of evolution.
Yeah.
And science itself has only been popularly accepted in what, the past 100 years? Maybe not even.
Right.
So,
okay.
You know, we're debating something that really hasn't had a chance to develop.
What, so science has that developed?
No, that the acceptance of science, melding science with interreligion. People leave religion. Yeah, they're going to leave because there's no alternative. But slowly but surely, we're developing that. You're here tonight talking about that. Mercatus is here.
But it's much more advanced than you're and Ezra giving you credit for. This is trivial what we're doing. I mean, this is done 100 times all over the place. This is radical to the community, but it's not radical in the Ashkenazic world. The Rabbi Tendlers of the world who have pieces of both. Yeah, exactly. Certain community has blinders on. Exactly.
In this community, have blinders on. We don't realize.
Absolutely. I mean, again,
the
Schroeders and the Aviyaz, all those books that we spoke about, all of them, there's tons of these people that have PhDs in Simcha. Tons of them, all over the place. It's an obvious point. It's not as limited as you guys think. To the contrary. The YU world is really manifest out there. Rabbis with PhDs in every discipline, whether it's classic, it's not a chidush.
But you have to admit, politically, we're not really seeing it. It's not being allowed.
Who's we?
The world. It's not being allowed to shine through.
No, only the community.
Only the community.
Serene community.
Oh, no.
The world.
Even Rabbi Berman has to tone down what he says.
That's a different. That's
because he's up against.
Saul Berman is talking about women's rights. Whole different issue. Who said that? It's a whole different issue. That's cutting edge in the modern Orthodox world. That science has been debated, discussed, with no science. No. There are no people who become irreligious because of science today. 50 years ago, 80 years ago, yes. Nowadays, we've solved the evolutionary problem one way or the other. And the ashes, we solved. These books are a dime a dozen. These things are passe. Women's issues and women's rights, cutting edge, modern, women's prayer groups, cutting edge, modern orthodoxy. What do we do with this? We don't really know. That's really an issue. Biblical criticism, that's a real issue. What do we do with that? That's really serious stuff. That's really something that you cannot work your way around. I'm seeing that differently. That's a different issue. How to merge archaeology and the Bible is very, very serious. Because there's no archaeological evidence, it's the Amitzrayim. So what do we do then? Do we say it anyway? Because you like it. That's what else you're going to do. That's what you got to do. Because it's fun, it's family, that's what you got to do. But there's no bill. How do you see 600,000 people times with all the families, 3 million people, traveling this and there's no remnants? It's impossible, archaeologically speaking. So that's another issue. That's more serious. This is easy. And eventually that also will be solvable as well. How to figure it out.
An atheist, sorry.
Yeah, no.
An atheist asked me, he was trying to make fun of the accidents and all that.
And he left?
No sign of, there's no evidence, no archaeological evidence.
That's
no,
silly, though, because that's obvious from silence. You can't argue from silence. Right, that's
so
silly.
I knew how to answer him.
Oh, good.
Dama should touch you.
Yes.
So I said to him, don't you know the Jewish people are a very clean people? Never behind.
2 points. Very good. Excellent.
In Fiddler on the Roof, what happens? They have to get out before the pogrom starts.
Right.
So Tevye is screaming, Goli, come on, let's get out before the pogrom starts. She says, wait a minute, I got to clean up the kitchen.
Right. Good point. Okay, let's go on. Now, in discussing evolution, we want to be aware that it will further intensify the question that astrophysics began. Whereas astrophysics displaced the Earth from the cherished theistic belief that it was the center of the universe, evolution displaces man from the cherished theistic belief that we are the focal point of divine creativity and concern. Yeah. Speak up.
I mean, we're going to challenge that now?
Yeah, evolution challenges that. Sorry? You'll see. Right now. Right now. Let's, before beginning to discuss a little bit what evolution is all about and see how it in fact pushes human being away from divine focus, or at least from the center of divine creativity, let's review for a moment the five-fold classification or the five-fold system of Jewish response to the challenges of science through religious belief that we spoke about last time. Right? It is premature over here. Why is it premature over here? Obviously because who said there's a need for a response? We may end up seeing that evolution and religion correspond so well, there's no need for a response. Right? So it is premature over here. First we have to discuss evolution, see if there's a challenge or not. If there's a challenge, then we'll talk about the five ways of responding. Right? Yeah?
Regardless of whether we, you outline evolution in a certain way, but God created, even if we agree evolution did occur, God created the whole process.
Maybe. Who said? Even if he did, why is there such... Not good enough. 40% of scientists believe that God could have had a role in evolution. However, then you have a question. If the essence of evolution is chance, mutations, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, why would God create a system where there's so much waste?
Waste.
All of those false starts.
Remember, we needed a billion combinations to make it work right.
Why?
What happened to the other hundreds of billions before that?
Which is much worse than we really think. So we'll get to that later on. But my question over here is, why should I present the five-fold classification of Jewish response when there may not be a need? Right? That's a question. If there's no possibility of an issue, of a challenge, why should we present the possibilities of responding?
Because you know that these five already unfolded. They're already played out.
No. That's not why I'm doing it now. Why am I doing it now? Because how some of us formulate the questions could be determined by the possibilities of responses. Say that again. How some of us formulate the questions could be determined by the possibilities of responses. What that means, if we knew that there is no answer to the challenge, would we perhaps be fearful of undermining our whole system of belief? That goes sort of like to what we said before by the sociology of knowledge. In other words, let's say that there's no answer to the problem of biblical criticism or to the problem of archaeology and the Exodus. If we knew in advance there's no answer, are we going to engage in the pursuit?
That's the best of our ability. And I found where we get to a point where
we say... No, am I going to tell my kids to study archaeology when I know it's going to raise all these questions and there's no answers? No possibility of an answer. Am I going to risk... So that's saying, do I want to risk my kid...
Then one day it'll be an explanation right now.
Is that an answer? That's not an answer, though. Maybe there may be an answer. I don't want to be committed to Judaism and doing Pesach and eating matzah for a whole entire week if it's no archaeological evidence for it.
But you take that very extreme to a lot of other subjects as well. We don't understand the Chavah Onesh. We don't understand...
But that's not scientific. I get away in not explaining that. Okay, but that's not a scientific discipline. And I'm not challenged by anything in that area. With the exception of the problem of evil, I'm not challenged by those issues. In the issue of archaeology or biblical criticism, I have facts that are contradicting my biblical statements. So what do I do now? So many will say, don't even enter into that area unless you have a possible response to it. Should one teach a course, let's say, in a Jewish school on Bikoret HaMikra? Bikoret HaMikra, biblical criticism. Right? Should one teach that course? Yeshiva University is famous for this. It's a great institution for many, many reasons. Yet, when it was giving out PhDs in Bible, it was not teaching biblical criticism. which is intellectually irresponsible. You cannot call yourself an accredited institution of higher learning to giving out a PhD in Bible without teaching biblical criticism. When I was going to teach university, that was an issue. So how did we get around it? Because YU was Jewish. So you had to get around everything in any which way. What do you do then? We didn't do that either. It's interesting. What they did is they ended up giving up PhDs, not in Bible, but in medieval biblical exegesis, Parshanut HaMikra, where you could avoid the problem of biblical criticism. This Chaim Soloveitchik said this, I'm not saying this. He was the dean of the school, said, we can't teach biblical criticism, it's kfira, it's against the Torah, we can't teach it, therefore you got a PhD in Bible. Right? It's equivalent to getting a PhD in biology and not teaching evolution. Whether you believe it or not, it's irrelevant. You must teach evolution, getting a PhD in biology, right? Obviously. So getting a PhD in Bible without teaching biblical criticism, it's irresponsible. When I was going to apply to graduate schools, the two premier schools in the country were Harvard and Brandeis, with the greatest scholars, right? What was it between these two schools? If you went to Brandeis, it was non-denominational, not religious. In other words, you learned everything in your field from an academic, scientific point of view. If you went to Harvard, you were able to study with Rabbi Twersky, who's a Hasidic Rebbe, essentially, and do Jewish history, and limit yourself from engaging in any of these kinds of issues. You studied Bible in the medieval period, not in the biblical period. So you didn't do anything to do with biblical history, biblical criticism. You have to deal with that. That was a major issue. So a lot of people ended up choosing going to that school. So I don't deal with these issues. I don't want to raise the question whether or not there was a miracle of Hanukkah, which could be questioned on various grounds, academic, historical grounds. Right? It's not listed in the Sefer HaMakabim, it's not listed in our press, whatever it may be. So people don't want to enter into Talmudic history because it raises all kinds of scientific, historical questions. So that was, if you went to Harvard, you could avoid all of that. Get a great PhD and avoid all of that. A lot of Torah Das guys went there. They wanted to do advanced Jewish studies, they went to that school. Other people said, no, I want to do it all with the most academic respectability, and then we're going to the other school, where it's pure scholarship, wherever it leads you. Right? So that was your choice. Same issue of YU. Do you teach biblical criticism, even though there are no answers to it at that point in time, 30, 40 years ago? So YU said, no, we're not going to do it that way. We teach Pashanut, and that's what it is. Nowadays, it's a bit different. Nowadays, we're more able to respond to biblical criticism somewhat satisfactorily. Not completely so, but somewhat satisfactorily. Up to 1975, Brandeis would take no YU students. Why not? Because they didn't feel they were intellectually honest. They came with a whole baggage of religion that's not going to enable or allow them to study scientifically, whereas to be studied scientifically. One second. So therefore, they didn't. Our year was actually the first year that it took students from YU. Why, I don't know. But I do know, actually. Because Nachum Sarno, who was the head of the department at that point, would not take any YU students, but he changed, and Marvin Fox became the head. He was willing to take YU because he thought that we could handle this kind of stuff and be responsible about it. Interesting issue. That's what you're talking about. Should we deal with disciplines, Miriam, that we don't have answers to? So if we are, we may want to deal with it differently if there's no answers to it. So if there's no response to evolution, then perhaps we should either raise it or raise it differently. Right? That's the question I'm raising. We may formulate our problem in a less threatening fashion in order not to be confronted by this non-answerable challenge to religion. So perhaps maybe we should know what are the possible responses before we even tackle the question, which is why I'm doing that first. Yeah.
Prior to science's acceptance of the Big Bang in
1975.
How did YU's PhD program in astronomy and astrophysics teach?
I don't think they had a program in astronomy in the 1930s.
How would they?
Have they done that? An equally good question might be, how does YU deal with evolution in its PhD program or undergraduate? We train a tremendous number of physicians. YU goes to Einstein, all that stuff, right? How do you do it? How does Flatbush deal with evolution? How does Ezra, how did your school do with evolution?
Barely.
I wouldn't say what school you go to, but so that's, I mean, that's an interesting question. Okay, Flatbush, you with Flatbush?
Yeah.
Okay, Flatbush, okay, Ezra, so Ezra goes to Shad Torah?
Oh, yeah.
So how do we deal with it there? You're a senior.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did you deal with it?
Ooh, problems, major problems. Quoting you sometimes.
No, no, you quoted me? Don't quote me. How do the teachers present it? Because that's a school that's the question.
Well, the English teachers basically ignored the rules and just taught it like a regular subject.
Interesting, ignored the rules.
We just did Mikraot Gedolot Bereshit, and they rejected it flat out. But I tried trying. There's one Ramban that says something about Tohu Vavohu.
Correct. Good.
In a way, too.
Right.
But actually, the thing I was basically having an argument with my entire class. And the thing I last ended up saying was the thing you first said, which was evolution up to man, and then God created man separately.
Okay, we'll see if that works. We didn't discuss that yet.
I really hope so.
We're going to discuss that. Okay, good. So that question, how does Flatbush versus Shaddai Torah deal with it? How does YU deal with it?
Actually, in Stern, as teenagers, we don't have evolution as part of that question.
Impossible. That's impossible. Wait, Taryn Bacon is a PhD in biology. You're a biology major at Stern, and you know evolution?
It's not even on the...
I can't believe that. I'm calling up Karen Bacon tomorrow morning. No, it's really, it's impossible. I mean, your teachers are... That can't be a directive from... Because why does teach evolution? Everybody go to YU here, biology people? I mean, we learned evolution in biology at YU, with Dr. Rubin.
I think biology is a principle, so I don't know, but I know there's no specific science for a major in biology.
There must be courses that deal with it in some fashion. What year are you in? Okay, so let me know in 2 years. If not, we'll see how this discussion evolves till then. That's interesting. I mean, that's strange. Very strange. I was told, by the way, that as a professor at YU, Moshe Bernstein, who was a PhD in Bible, and a very serious and a good scholar, and when I came to teach at Stern, I was told by Rabbi Berman, please don't do what Moshe Bernstein did. I said, what was that? He taught a course in Bible at Stern, which when a woman at Stern, who was going out with a smicha student with Rav Schachter, who was my Rebbe at YU, when Rav Schachter heard about what she was learning at Stern, Rav Schachter told her, either she drops the course or you break the shidduch.
Wow.
So Rav Berman said to me, we can't stop that, because we have to get kids married. So don't teach anything that's going to break any shidduchs. So I was responsible. I didn't. So YU is a good example of the stress, the tension of how to deal with these kinds of issues. YU, Norman Lamb will tell you how the professor of chemistry, 40 years ago when he took chemistry in the 1950s, how he challenged them as an atheist would. Because he, Professor Keshi, was an atheist, yet YU was able to entertain atheism on its secular faculty, all the while it taught Torah in the morning classes. So YU did have that pull and push struggle with these kinds of issues. So, let's just formulate now the five responses. We don't want to formulate our evolutionary issue in a fashion which can point to all of its inherent problems, as some rabbis do, because some rabbis believe that we cannot really respond to it, therefore they're going to formulate the question, if they know the question, in the most simplistic fashion possible rather than the most sophisticated fashion possible, because they don't have an answer. But if we believe that we do and can respond to it, then we will give evolution its just due and formulate the problem in its most sophisticated fashion. Right? In effect, what I'm saying is that many rabbis set up what we call a straw dummy, which is easy to tear down. Right? We all know what a straw dummy is. Set up a false image and then easily just knock it down. Rather than set up a real, serious, sophisticated model of evolution and then see how to deal with it. Right? So now, we're going to try to deal this issue in an intellectually responsible fashion because we know how to operate within the categories of responses. What did we say last time about the possible responses to all these issues? A, there are those who are rejectionists. Those who reject all science, This is your right-wing community. This is your Lakewood or Baltimore or wherever it may be community. Rejecting all of science is something to teach us. Torah is true. Torah is absolutely true. And that's the end of the discussion. Period. Right? B, second category, the isolationists. Those, so as I said before, and this is a lot of why you people, who say science is true and religion is true and the twain don't meet. They live their lives in a very compartmentalized fashion where each compartment is very isolated from the other. They don't live integratedly. They don't live in terms of this issue. They live in two very different worlds. It's a very difficult and a very interesting position to take. Because you challenge them, how do you believe in this and how do you believe in this? And they say, when I'm in shul, I believe in this. When I'm in school, I believe in this. And it doesn't really work, yet they make it work for them. And I could challenge you and think of areas where you yourselves live in two different worlds. Right? In many areas, we all do this. What happens in shul has nothing to do with my work week, right? And I don't let these two worlds mix. So the isolationist accepts science and accepts religion as literally true, and yet they don't even think of connecting those two dots. Third, integrationists. Here we have the full-throated integration of the Rambam, who's willing to say that I'm going to accept science at face value. If it's proven, it's true, I accept it. That's integration model number one. And question number two is the Ramban, who I would say, I think it's true, is not as bold, as powerful, as marching forward as the Ramban. The Ramban challenges science much more so than the Rambam did. The Rambam's worldview of Aristotelian physics was accepted by the Rambam, and therefore all the Rambam said about the universe and whatever was based on it religiously, namely its proofs for God's existence, of course, is challenged when Aristotelian view of the universe was overthrown. Right? We have a new model of the universe, then we have to raise all those questions all over again. Ramban didn't buy into as much as the Rambam did into Aristotelian physics, certainly because of Kreskos. We should be aware that Kreskos challenged successfully Aristotelian notions of the universe. Right? So the Ramban was saying more so, I'm going to question much more the science. Rambam accepted it. Not at face value, because he believed it was proven as true. The Rambam, who knew logic well, who knew science well, accepted Aristotelian premises as well as their conclusions. Ramban was not as quick to accept it. So those are two models of integration. Now the last category are those, what I would call, deceptive, dishonest loyalists. Those who are loyal to Jewish tradition, irrespective of what science teaches, but do so, they're loyal by virtue of painting a false picture of what science is, or a distorted picture of science. That is, as we said, they will accept the science, they're not reductionists, the science that proves religion. And any scientific statement that is a challenge to religion, they will reject. And last time I gave you examples of that.
Big DeMille.
I didn't use that example. I did, but I don't want to say that anymore. I was said to myself, I'm not going to say it again. But that is true. Rejoice, O youth, will in fact, at the beginning of our pages, prove to you why science proves religion. But all the rest of science, which Shabbos never talks about. It's easy to do that. The Rambam, Moreh Nevuchim, Part 1, Chapter 71, rants and raves against the Mutakalimun, the Islamic theologians, David, who do exactly that. They use the science of the times to prove religion and never raise any of the scientific challenges to religion. That's intellectually dishonest. From the Rambam's point of view, the Rambam pursued truth at all costs. And that fifth group, which many rabbis do, many rabbis will only accept science to the point which it proves religion, and any challenges, however they view that, they will not accept. So we're not going to accept neither view. Number one, we're not going to reject science. Number two, we're not going to be isolationists. Number three, we're not going to be that fifth category of deceptive, dishonest loyalists, although we're going to be loyal anyway. We're going to live, Miriam, better with the tension of not knowing sometimes, rather than try to prove religion falsely with a false picture of science, distorted picture of science, right? And rather, what we're going to try to do is integrate. Either according to the model of the Rambam or the Ramban. The Ramban's model is preferred. It shows a great degree of intellectual modesty. And it's a good model. On the other hand, it doesn't suit my complete taste because I am bolder than the Ramban, but not as bold as the Rambam. I don't have as much courage as the Rambam. Sorry? Oh, I don't. I really don't. I know me. So I don't have as much courage as the Rambam. The Rambam was a truly extraordinary personality, and therefore I cannot do that. I can't be as bold as the Rambam. On the other hand, I'm not comfortable either with the Ramban because he wasn't willing to go far enough. Right? More practically, one might say, applying these categories, that the Rambam were to, if he were to read all the evolutionary stuff that you're going to read, the Rambam would look at the 1,000 experiments that, we'll use the word prove, because the Rambam was too sophisticated for that, but that point in a direction of a serious acceptance of evolution. The Rambam would therefore conclude that these 1,000 experiments can only be explained by some theory of evolution. And he will then therefore try to reinterpret to make that make sense. What would the Ramban say? He would say, look, your theory of evolution up to this point is only a theory. There's a lot of faults and flaws in it. You have all those missing links. We have many false statements. And therefore, I am not willing to accept it even as a workable hypothesis at this point. The Ramban, I believe, would say that if he were to read evolution. It is too problematic for the Ramban's taste. And therefore, he won't bother reinterpreting. The Ramban would say, look at all this evidence. Not provable, look at all this evidence. Let's reinterpret. So I think it'd be correct to say, this is somewhat speculative, but it's correct to say that that's why the Rambam as an integrationist and the Ramban as an integrationist would deal with this particular problem. Okay? So we are somewhere between the Ramban and the Rambam. I don't know where that puts me. But it puts me someplace, hopefully. So, we now want to begin very briefly in 1 minute, what evolution is all about. Okay? And the best way of beginning is by presenting it, I guess, historically. That's the simplest way of presenting a very complex phenomenon. Right? What is evolution all about? Answer in one word, change. That's it. In other words, what took place? I'll open by reading one paragraph from this wonderful work. The publication of Charles Darwin on the Origin of Species in 1859 was the most important event in an intellectual revolution that continues to affect today many areas of thought. The concept of evolution has changed our understanding of nature and therefore changed our views of humanity and our view of God's relation to nature. Powerful statement. What took place? Took place is in 1859, on the ship Beagle, Charles Darwin, as a naturalist, took a 5-year voyage. He took the voyage to understand, as a religious man, what nature is all about. He noticed, he didn't try to, but he noticed small variations between similar species. Species that are very similar, and yet they differed in some fashion or other. Utilizing good scientific methodology, which is observation and logical analysis, and a bit of speculation, he came to a conclusion that one species must have evolved from the other. He didn't know about genetic mutation, but he did know about very famous work, Richard Malthus' work on population, right. Yeah, he had read 6 years earlier Malthus' essay on human population, competing for limited resources, and then two ideas which became central to evolution he adopted. One, in any given population, there's going to be small random variations which can be inherited. Right? In any random population, Because he didn't know why. We know genetic mutations. He didn't know that. But he did see variations. So any large population is going to be small random variations, point number one. And point number two is what?
There's always more babies than can be.
No. Point number two that he considered essential is that in the struggle for survival, these slight variations are going to give slight advantages to that particular species to survive. And what is that called?
Survival of the fittest.
Right. Or natural selection. Those two terms. Natural selection. Nature will favor those species that have changed some variation. That is, the bird with a slightly longer beak is going to survive over time. And all those birds with very small beaks are going to die out. Nature will favor those species that have changed a bit with a slight variation. Right? That, in a capsule form, is what Darwinian evolution is all about. Yes, Alan?
So if evolution was a change, what made it stop? What made us all stop at this point?
Why did we stop? It shouldn't have stopped. God forbid it stopped.
God forbid it stopped.
It's not evolving like, you know, it's
so small. Okay, what is 100 years?
Right, so the answer to that, Alan, is missing is that this takes, you say hundreds of years?
No, I said we're only looking at a slice of 100 years.
Right, 100, yeah. Yes. Yes. So there are many experiments which show mutations and changes. It's all verifiable. And yet, it's much more complex than that. That's the straw dummy. What I just said to you was a simplified version of Darwinian evolution. Truth to tell, Jay Gould, preeminent biologist at Harvard, Alav Shalom, who was one, just passed away a few months ago, a year ago, who came up with a much more sophisticated evolutionary system called punctuated
equilibrium.
Right. So he spoke about that issue, which is a much more sophisticated form of it. But for our purposes, what I want to end now, because we're getting tired, and I want you to think about, does that form of evolution challenge Bereshit? And if it does, come up with a solution. Got it? Homework?
Does that form
of evolution, but we just said evolution, as it is, I want you to formulate the question properly, which is, given that definition of evolution, let's use that definition of evolution for our purposes right now, does it challenge Bereshit? And if it does, how are you going to resolve it? Yeah, you think? Not good enough. Come back next week. Yes. Thank you all for coming.
Did Darwin see genetic mutations and see that this is...
No, you know nothing about
genetics. I assume he didn't actually see it, but was that what his understanding, or did he simply say giraffes have different sized necks, and the ones with the longer necks get the food better, and they evolved to, you know, an animal of long necks?
Right, correct.
So he saw it as just differences within the species.
Yes. He didn't know how. Yes, exactly. He didn't know how it happened. Thank you. Good seeing you.